Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
He's the former Obama ambassador to Belgium and co-star of Politics and Pints. It's As I See It with Howard Gutman on News Radio WRVA.
Good morning and welcome to episode 25 of As I See It. Yes, you heard me right. We have hit a quarter of the century mark or something like that, maybe half a year mark. But we have been doing As I See It. This is now episode 25. And we have been doing the same thing. Not just telling you what the left says and mimicking those words. Certainly not mimicking the words of the right. But analyzing the issues of policy and politics. Laughing at and with our world of politics. And getting to the heart of what matters. So how the heck are we going to celebrate episode 25? How can you do it in this world of politics? Surely, if you have been watching MSNBC or CNN or Fox News or my dear friends at News Nation, you're saying politics is getting kind of boring. Joe Biden's pretty capable. And the arguments are like, should we spend more or less in the infrastructure bill? Is there too much stuff stuck in like normal in the infrastructure bill? Or how much can we have a president enhance the gun restrictions without violating the Second Amendment? And nah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. Well, on our 25th episode of As I See It, we will have none of the nah, 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 or blah, blah, blah. We are going to look today at the single most important question in politics today. Let me repeat that. The single most important question in politics today. And it is a question you have never heard mentioned anywhere. Not on MSNBC, not on CNN, not on Fox, and certainly not on News Nation, because I talked to the main host, Joe Donilon, Thursday night and chat about it with him, and he was amazed. The single most important question in American politics today is, will Florida Governor Ron DeSantis agree to arrest Donald Trump and to extradite Donald Trump to New York, to arrest Donald Trump and hand Donald Trump to Governor Andrew Cuomo? Let that sink in. The single most important question that affects totally the 2024 election, the leadership of the Republican Party, the path forward for Democrats, is would Ron DeSantis agree to arrest and extradite Donald Trump if and when requested by New York under the name of Governor Andrew Cuomo? Now, if we have time, we'll try to explore some of the other wackiness in politics. Thank God for America. It's a great country. For example, we have a 71-year-old transgender woman who has never served a day in government as dominating the news about the California governor's election and recall as a Republican. Yes, a 71-year-old transgender woman who's never been in politics is the leading Republican right now. I love American politics. And we have a businessman whose parents were born in Taiwan and has also never served a single day in government, who's not only dominating the news about the New York mayor's race. He is leading it. And then in Florida this weekend, we have three groups meeting simultaneously. Three groups of Republicans trying to figure out which group controls the Republican Party going forward. So there's plenty of follies to be covered, but in fact, let's focus on the most important question in American politics today, whether Governor Ron DeSantis would arrest and extradite Donald Trump when requested by Democrat and despised Democrat for Republicans, Andrew Cuomo in New York. Now, how the heck is this a relevant question? Well, let me explain. And luckily, I had 27 years of boring white-collar crime practice as a litigator at the leading firm, probably in the world, Williams & Connolly in Washington. So this is a bit up my alley. When you commit a crime, you can commit different kinds of crimes. You can commit a federal offense that's investigated by the U.S. attorney's offices around the country and enforced by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or you can commit state crimes, usually looked at by the district attorneys throughout the state and enforced by state law enforcement. Now, often the same acts can violate federal law and can violate state law. And Donald Trump is subject right now to three main criminal investigations, two of which I suspect will go nowhere, and one of which I suspect will certainly go somewhere. So the District of Columbia, the equivalent of the state of Washington, D.C., is investigating the Capitol riot, the Capitol insurrection, and I don't believe they will be able to put together a case to indict Donald Trump on that insurrection. I don't expect that. And then the Fulton County, that's the county in which Atlanta, Georgia is in. The Fulton County prosecutor is trying to investigate whether there was fraud, whether there was illegal influence in an election based on Donald Trump's calls after the election, where he tried to convince Brad Raffensperger and Brian Kemp to find him more votes. And Lindsey Graham weighed in. And so that local prosecutor, a state crime, is investigating Donald Trump there as well. And again, I believe that will end up short. But the main investigation involves the finances of the Trump Organization. This is quite common. So when you make government reports and you make reports to banks and you file your taxes, if you lie on it, if you cheat on your taxes, if you cheat an insurance company by lying, if you cheat a bank by lying, that often will violate both federal law and state law. And so, for example, it is not that uncommon, but can be illegal. If you are looking at a property, let's say the Trump Tower in Manhattan, and you want to borrow against the Trump Tower in Manhattan, so you're trying to get the bank to give you the most money that they would give you. And so you provide representations about the value of the Trump Tower that you'll try to make as high as possible. If there is insurance issues, depending on whether the insurance company will be paying you or charging you, you might try to make that same property's value seem as high or low as possible. And for taxes, if you have to pay, let's say, property tax, you're going to say, well, although the building looks like this and is appraised at this, you've got to understand there's all these problems at the building and you will try to make the valuations as low as possible. And then someone might look and say, what did you tell the bank the property was worth? And what did you tell the property tax that it was worth? And lo and behold, they're not always consistent. And that is the essential actions that I believe are being looked at. That can be federal offense, federal bank fraud, federal insurance fraud, tax fraud against the United States government, or it can be state crimes. Property tax is local. It can be a state tax offense. It can be a state fraud offense. So either jurisdiction could look at it. And I believe there's investigations, the Wall Street Journal has reported, going on about Donald Trump's property at the Trump Tower. about a property called Seven Springs, which is an estate in Westchester, New York, and about a hotel in Chicago. So those three are being looked at. Now, do I believe they will be federal investigations? I do not. First of all, because New York is obviously doing it. Second of all, Joe Biden and Merrick Garland need this headache the way you fill it in. They do not need this headache. Merrick Garland's got an agenda he wants to take at the Department of Justice. Joe Biden's got an agenda of infrastructure and things he wants to accomplish, COVID, that he wants to accomplish for the country. The Republicans would love to reduce their administrations to a political battle over going after Donald Trump and stopping all the work that they hope to do that's worthwhile. So I don't think Merrick Garland, our Attorney General of the United States, or Joe Biden, the president, will have any interest in federal investigations. But in the state of New York, this is a popular crime to look at, which is why Donald Trump responds that this is all Democrat-inspired political politics. He's being victimized. And to that extent, he isn't wrong. On the other hand, to the extent that you've violated the law, other people who are not Donald Trump get prosecuted for this stuff every day. So it's not purely political. It isn't. It's political in that it's high profile. Maybe they looked at you and they found you. But if they had found it on someone else, they would have gone after that as well. So I believe you probably won't see any charges in Georgia. You probably won't see it in Washington, D.C. But we will likely see charges in New York State. And at some point, Donald Trump will likely get indicted in New York State. Now, what we know is that Trump Organization has hired criminal defense attorney Ronald Fischetti. We know exactly where the prosecution's going. And the question is, after he gets indicted, the fun will begin. We will go after that fun right after this. And at the bottom of the hour, we have a very special guest. We have Peter Francio. He's the long-serving controller of the state of Maryland and the favorite to be the next governor of the state of Maryland. That's at the bottom of the hour. But the fun will begin as to what happens after Donald Trump gets indicted right after this. You're listening to Newsradio WRVA 1140 AM and 96.1 FM. I'm Howard Gutman, and this is As I See It.
You're listening to As I See It on Newsradio WRVA. Here's former U.S. Ambassador Howard Gutman.
Thanks so much, Kyle. Shout out to Kyle Scott. Maybe we'll do it a little more later, but I'm excited to plow ahead with what we've been talking about, the most important question in American politics, whether Ron DeSantis would arrest and extradite Donald Trump at the request of not his most favorite person, at the request of Andrew Cuomo in New York. So we've established that New York has that investigation going forward. In fact, the Trump Organization just hired and added another high-profile defense counsel. It's Ronald Fischetti. Now, Ronald Fischetti used to be partners with Mark Pomerantz. Mark Pomerantz is a white-collar criminal defense attorney at one of the leading firms in New York and in the world, Paul Weiss. And he has taken a leave of absence to join the Manhattan DA's office to lead this investigation. And so Ron Fischetti used to be Pomerantz's partner. The Trump Organization has brought him in to defend the investigation. These guys know each other and they go way back. And when I say way back, I mean way back, because I remember as being a young attorney and having cases with Fischetti and Pomerantz being sort of just a bit older. And I can tell you, I am no spring chicken. I am staring Social Security in the eye. So I couldn't believe Ron Fischetti was still around. He is 84 years old. He's still a vigorous attorney. And he will lead the Trump Organization defense. And he is my new hero, not because he's leading the Trump Organization defense, because when I'm 84 years old, I want to take on the most exciting new aspect of my entire career. So congratulations to Ron Fischetti, but that's fascinating. And the government is proceeding the way the government usually proceeds. So it's a tough case, if you ask me, because first of all, we talked about different valuations of properties depending on who you're talking to. The questions aren't always the same. Conditions change. You rely on different appraisers. But it's particularly hard because I don't think Donald Trump was the guy who told anyone specifically what valuation to use. Or was he? Who would know the role of Donald Trump in committing bank fraud or insurance fraud or tax fraud? Well, of course, that would be Alan Weisselberg. Alan Weisselberg is the most important person in this scenario, in this breaking news. He has long been the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization. He's the guy who fills out all the financial forms, and he can say, Donald Trump told me to change this figure, or Donald Trump did not. So the government wants to get Weisselberg to testify against Trump. But if you've been the guy's chief financial officer forever and you've made a lot of money and you still work for him, you don't really want to testify against him. So the government needs to put pressure on Alan Weisselberg. How would they put pressure on Alan Weisselberg? They will try to put pressure on his son, Barry Weisselberg. Now, this is dirty. I was a criminal defense lawyer for 27 years. The government does not play fair. They will take your arm behind your back and bend it until you cry uncle. So now they want to get Barry Weisselberg to make Alan Weisselberg, the Trump Organization chief financial officer, cooperate against Donald Trump. How can they get him? Barry doesn't want to talk any more than Alan does. And there it is, the ex-wife. One of the reasons never get divorced is there's someone who doesn't like you who knows your inner secrets. And that would be Jennifer Weisselberg. And yesterday, the FBI, the state prosecutors seized Jennifer Weisselberg's boxes that she has about Barry Weisselberg from their divorce. So I believe New York will go forward. Let's now turn to the fun issues. Because if you get indicted federally, if the U.S. Attorney's Office indicted you, you are a citizen of the United States. You can be arrested by the federal government no matter what state you're in. They just send the FBI. That's the law enforcement that works with the federal government. Those are the federal police. And they say you've just been extradited in federal court in New York. Go to Florida, you FBI, and go arrest him. It takes no intervention by governors. But remember, we just said that this is a New York State prosecution, and we explained why. So if the New York State indicts Donald Trump, they then have to find him and have him arrested and sent back to New York State to stand trial. The process of sending someone from one state to another to stand trial is called extradition. They would need to extradite Donald Trump. Now, there is a statute, a federal statute, and there is, in fact, a constitutional provision that would actually require one jurisdiction, Florida, to extradite someone from another jurisdiction. There isn't really a choice. If Trump is charged in one state, there is a constitutional provision and a federal statute that says he has to be sent back to the state that he is wanted in by the state where he is found. It is simply a ministerial job by that state, the state where he's found, to order his arrest, to arrest him and send it back. That ministerial task is done by the governor. So officially, when New York requests extradition from Florida, it's a ministerial request from Andrew Cuomo. It's ministerially signed by the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. The state police in Florida then arrest the guy, Donald Trump in this case, and send him back. But it does take that ministerial task. So, in this case, let's look at ministerial tasks. Mike Pence had the ministerial task of certifying the election. Donald Trump said, no, make it discretionary. Use your discretion. Refuse to certify it. And we had the riot. We had that January 6th riot. When the Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, and Brian Kemp, the governor, had the ministerial task of certifying the Georgia election, if you'll recall, Donald Trump told them not to do it. They went forward and did their ministerial duty, and now Brad Raffensperger will be beat, and he will not get reelected. Donald Trump will defeat him. Do you think Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who is a Trumpite, the governor of Florida, who if Trump does not run, is leading the Republican pack for president in 2024, will do that ministerial task? We will investigate it later in the show. As I told you at the bottom of the hour, we've got controller Peter Francho. Look forward to it. You're listening to News Radio WRVA 1140 AM and 96.1 FM. I'm Howard Gutman, and this is As I See It.
You're listening to As I See It on News Radio WRVA. Here's former U.S. Ambassador Howard Gutman.
Thanks, Kyle. Welcome back. As you know, on As I See It, we pride ourselves on interviewing the leading newsmakers and the leaders, and far better when they are friends. We'd rather have a chat with a friend than ask routine questions to a boring person in the news. And our guest this week has been a friend of mine probably for three decades, and has been a fabulously successful politician and government official in Maryland, serving for what will be 16 years as the comptroller in Maryland. In the 2018 election, Peter Francho got the most votes ever cast for a candidate in a statewide Maryland election. Sounds a little bit what Donald Trump's saying about the Republican Party nationally, but in Peter's case, he actually did win. And he's now running for governor of Maryland as a Democrat to succeed Republican Larry Hogan. Now, let me explain why that matters and why Peter's such a crucial person. 38 states will have governor's races over the next 2 years. Democrats hold 18 of those seats. Republicans hold 20. Of those 20 Republican seats, there is only one state that is favored to flip from Republican red to Democrat blue, and that is Maryland, and our guest is favored to lead that flip. So welcome to As I See It. Peter, tell me how you're doing.
Howard, I'm doing just fine, and please give my regards to Michelle, your better half, and also your two sons, and I hope you're doing well. I'm delighted to reconnect with you because Howard Gutman has a certain kind of niche in the Francho household, because in 2004, my wife and my then, let's see, kind of late adolescent teenage daughter, went to your house, I think, because you did a fundraiser for George Clooney's father. That I have heard about that single event more than anything else over the last few years. So thank you for giving me the kind of gold standard. I don't think I'll ever be able to hold something like that in my house. But did Nick Clooney actually win, or did he not succeed, I guess?
So Nick Clooney didn't succeed because he was running in Cincinnati as a Democrat. But I did have Nick and his wife and George at the house, which is still the most popular thing we've done here. But I got to tell you, Peter, 5 minutes before George and his parents are set to arrive, Michelle leans over to me and says, I've never told you this, but if I'm ever going to cheat on you, it would be with George Clooney.
Yeah, well, I could see that. But it doesn't surprise me if he was running as a Democrat in Cincinnati, because years ago, I was not living at home, but my dad relocated with my mom to Cincinnati for a job with Bristol-Myers or Brackett or something like that out there. And he was a kind of moderate corporate lawyer. He was a Democrat, Adlai Stevenson and all that kind of stuff. He was considered to be basically a communist out in Cincinnati, because they are so conservative in that part of the country. And so it doesn't surprise me that a Democrat may have lost for Congress back in the day.
I know it well. I clerked on the Supreme Court, both Justice O'Connor, but also Justice Potter Stewart, who was from Cincinnati. And I was from Queens, New York. and you can still have a TV sitcom, The Justice and the Clerk, the Patrician Cincinnati Thin Ties, and the kid from Whitestone, Queens with wild hair. We got along fabulously. But let's turn to Peter Franchot's last year or so. So you've been helping to lead a state going through COVID as the controller. First, give us a sense of what it's been like, but then also what the effect on COVID will be on the state and the finances, and what people may not think about daily as they listen to this, but in their own states.
Well, first of all, it's been a devastating year, obviously, for the economy, but also primarily for more than 8,000 Marylanders who have died, 450,000 who have been infected. So it's been a tragic year. And, you know, the comptroller's office is one of only three statewide offices in Maryland. We elect a governor. We do not separately elect a lieutenant governor. The lieutenant governor has to run with the gubernatorial candidate. And we have attorney general and we have comptroller. And comptroller is an elected position. I'm the tax administrator, the chief fiscal officer of the state. And we have, in addition to that, a unique three-member panel called the Board of Public Works. So I administer the tax system, collect all the taxes, do all sorts of other fiscal things. But every 2 weeks, I get together with the governor and the treasurer, and we have to approve 50 to 60 contracts at each meeting every 2 weeks, averaging $450 million at each session in state contracts. These are not authorizations or appropriations or anything like that. These are actual contracts. So I'm lucky in that I've got a job where I both see the money coming in and actually get to be one of, you need two votes out of three, and we're all independently there. So it tends to be a unique Action Central panel. Other states do not have things like this. They have appointed comptrollers. They have boards of estimates that are controlled by the governor or by the mayor or something like that. So it's a great job. On the issue of money, we're just announcing that we're going to do a complete top-to-bottom review of all $50 billion that we estimate has come to the state of Maryland in a 12-month period. This is just a river of cash that's come to the state of Maryland from the federal government. Last summer, we had the stimulus plan, then we had the relief plan in December. Now we have the Biden plan. This is equal to 1 year's entire budget in the state of Maryland.
So listening to Peter Franchot, the controller of Maryland. So Peter, is it fair to say if you were worried about what might happen to your government because of the hit the economy took, that from a perspective of Maryland, with all the federal incentives and the like, the budget seems to be fine or quite in the black?
Yeah, I am welcoming the relief with open arms because, our experts said we were going to have a dire situation with a big drop-off in tax revenues because of 1 million new unemployment claims a year ago. And that's what normally happens in recessions, Howard. Didn't happen because of the CARES Act. $2.2 trillion, chunk of that came to Maryland. It stabilized the economy. Obviously, it stabilized the stock market and the state's economy and the national economy. I think we're saved by this John Maynard Keynes approach to if you're in trouble and you have a recession or a depression, spend a lot of money. It was a real education for our experts because we were a year ago predicting that this would really be a bad situation economically. And So we've got kind of a different view of it. We still have two Marylands. One third of our state is in the deepest recession since the 1930s. And these are low wage earners who generally are in the hospitality sector. I'm sure you have it in Virginia also. That group, and it's a large group, is just up the creek without a paddle right now. They have nothing. And the two thirds of folks like you and me and others who got paid, work remotely, live in homes that are protected from coronavirus, more or less, we're okay. And normally, what the only thing I want to report to your listeners is what the The fact is that this relief money sealed off the recession in the low-wage earners. It did not spread into the other two-thirds of Virginia or Maryland's economy. That, in and of itself, is proof positive that the relief was a good thing in retrospect. We are going to do a whole top-to-bottom review of it. We're starting that right now. I'd love to collaborate with Virginia because we want to make sure the relief money, much as we appreciate it, was spent on people who need it and businesses that needed it, make sure there wasn't too much fraud. There's always going to be some fraud. And make sure that there wasn't what I call pandemic profiteering by the private sector where, you know, some companies just launch off into unethical areas and abuse the U.S. Treasury and the state treasury. We at Zicanda used to work for them. They're probably going to defend some of these companies down the road because there's, you know, there's just some, unfortunately, egregiously bad examples.
If there's people in trouble, William Zicanda is usually around. Let's turn a little bit to the politics. Let's turn to the governor's race. The governor's race, as I mentioned, there's only two races this November. Phil Murphy getting reelected in New Jersey and then the fight in Virginia. But the year after will be the Maryland race. Larry Hogan, the current Republican governor, can't run. You are running. Can you tell us who you expect to be running in the Democrat side and the Republican side, and how do you see the race playing out?
Well, it's unclear. I'm all in. I've put all the chips on the table, and I don't have to run. I'm not term limited like Governor Hogan is in his position. But I will have been, as you noted, comptroller for 16 years at the end of this term. So I'm put all my chips on the table. I'm all in. I've told people to run, you know, announce and run for my old seat, and there are a number of good candidates who have announced. There haven't been a whole group of candidates running for governor. There's a lot of gossip about who's running and who isn't. And my view right now is that all of the candidates that have been mentioned are running until they aren't. It's unclear. There are a lot of people that have been out of politics for some time who want to get back in. That's a normal impulse, but it's hard to do. There are other people that have current positions, county executives or members of Congress. They have to give something up because you can't run. You can't keep your county exec seat for a second term, for example, and also run for governor. So there's a lot of decision making down the road. I'm kind of a unique Democrat, and I'm more than happy to, I've said often, I'm happy to pay the filing fee for people that want to run against me because I believe in democracy and competition, and we'll just see how it goes. It's always a roll of the dice, as you know.
If people love politics the way I do, it is going to be a fascinating race to watch. You've got someone like Peter who has been in the state toiling, knows the state. No one knows it better than Peter Franco. You've got some people who know their particular counties. And then you have people like Tom Perez. Tom Perez was the leader of the DNC, was our labor secretary nationally. John Delaney was a congressman who ran for president. So national figures trying to swoop back in. Sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't. But it should be kind of fascinating. What do you expect the differences on the Democrat side will be, or do you think everyone will be running against the Republican concept or running towards Biden? It's a little hard because you're out of power in the state, but right now you control the House, the Senate. The Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the presidency. So how do you run with a Tom Perez or John Delaney or Peter Franco in that kind of race?
Well, Tom Perez is a neighbor of mine in Tacoma Park, and I know him and like him a lot. And John Delaney is a dear friend of mine also, who doesn't live in Tacoma Park. He lives out where you live, Howard, with the rich people. But both of those individuals are outstanding, and I have nothing but respect and nice things to say about them. And they may get in, others may get in. I suppose I'm going to be presenting myself to the public as A, someone who's made 10,000 visits to small businesses all over the state in the last 14 years, visited hundreds if not thousands of schools, someone who has done kind of kept the fiscal house in order and been a Democrat, yes, but not a robot, and certainly someone who wants to make sure the fiscal condition of the state is protected. I view myself not as a liberal Democrat, moderate Democrat, progressive Democrat, conservative Democrat. All of those, I think, do not apply to me. I view myself as an outsider. It's a little hard to accept that, I know, for someone like yourself looking in at the race, but because I've been in elected office for 34 years now. But I am an outsider at heart. I am a reformer. You mentioned my public interest background. Back in the day, you know, I worked for Ralph Nader Organizations, the Union of Concerned Scientists. I will always be with 99% of the public standing with my face in the window, pressed up against the window, looking in at how power is exercised in Annapolis or in Washington. I will never be, even though I have a lot of skill and a lot of knowledge about politics, I will never, I think, be viewed by the public as someone who is in the smoke-filled back room.
Now, Peter, federally, so much of the new monies and the infrastructure focus and the like have been focused on electric vehicles, alternative energy, changing over our economy to the new jobs in the alternative energy world. I know in Virginia, in Maryland, there are two offshore wind projects, and we have a kind of high-tech sector. How do you see Maryland fitting in with the Biden administration and this whole new push, and what advice would you have for the Biden administration?
Well, the Biden administration is like a perfect glove fitting over the hand of Maryland, because they are absolutely funding and articulating right now how important it is for the nation to adjust nimbly to the economy of the future, as we call it, which part of which is a heavy emphasis upon renewables, as you mentioned. Maryland's the same picture. I am, you know, if people go to franchot.com, my campaign website, we just put up yesterday, or the day before yesterday, we put up a list of 14 substantive pledges that I'm making to the citizens of the state, not kind of the traditional old empty campaign promises, but actual commitments that folks will be able to react to. And I urge everybody to go and read the 14. One of them is about making Maryland the first net zero carbon state in the country, and we're going to accelerate the transition to electric vehicles, among other things, but frankly, it's going to be much broader than that. And why is that important? It's important because that is going to, as you know, and Joe Biden has articulated this, that's going to create a lot of jobs, with well-paid jobs, with health care and pensions and perhaps union membership, that are each going to be a path to the middle class, which I define as ability to buy a house and have some financial stability. So how do you make Maryland the number one go-to state for, well, not even the country. I'm talking about Maryland being the number one entity in the world as far as a rapid transition to renewable energy. This is not easy. And you mentioned you may be available for a job down the road. I could. You want to know what a good job would be? If you come, we can't pay you a lot, and nothing like what you've made in your career. But we need somebody to manage, not the political will and political aspirations of someone like me, but take what I've said, which is we're going to take a bold approach to making Maryland a go-to place for, I call it the renewable energy capital of the world. That's what Maryland's going to be. And we need somebody to manage that, like you. So why don't you pull up all your corporate credentials, and if I'm lucky enough to be governor, come and sit down with me and help me organize that. It is one of our main pledges. And, it's we've got one bold pledge after another, but I start with the I start with a simple pledge, which is I'm going to, in the first 6 months as governor, fix every pothole on every state road, pick up the trash along state roads, and answer the telephone of every state agency within 60 seconds. And people say,
amen.
Well, the people say amen, but then they say, you're insane. You can't possibly do that. Government's so incompetent. No, we did it in the comptroller's office. We're known as a juggernaut of customer service. And we're just going to take those same management skills and lessons and apply them to all the state agencies.
So, Peter, I'm the real winner today, along with my listeners. I got the joy of talking to a friend and hearing really bold and hard thoughts for Maryland ahead, and I also got a job offer. I can't thank you enough for coming on. Best to you and Annie and the family. Stay safe, and I wish you the best going down the road.
Give my regards to Michelle and your family also, and, just let's stay in touch, and all my best to the listeners over in Virginia. We have to link up Virginia and Maryland, and D.C. has to have a very, very close regional working relationship. We'll all benefit from that.
Thanks so much. You're listening to News Radio WRVA 1140 AM and 96.1 FM, also nationwide on the Odyssey app. I'm Howard Gutman, and this is As I See It. We'll be right back.
So we're joined today by one of the greatest governors in our country, and I know a lot of good ones, and I can tell you there's some really bad ones, too. But this is a great one, Governor Ron DeSantis. Governor. Thank you, Ron. I heard your speech was great, Ron. I heard you did a great job, but he's done a great job, and he's been my friend. Hey, Ron, are we going to win the state, please? Okay. You know, if we don't win it, I'm blaming the governor. I'll fire him somehow. I'm going to fire him.
Now, that's Trump and Ron DeSantis kidding around during the presidential race. And the question we're examining is, would that same Ron DeSantis order the arrest of Donald Trump to send him back to Andrew Cuomo? The extradition clause of the Constitution says a person charged in any state, New York, with any other crime who shall be found in another state, this time Florida, shall on the demand of the executive authority of the state, that's Andrew Cuomo, from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime, back to New York. The Constitution requires it. The precedent in 1861, there was what was called a free man of color who helped a slave escape from Kentucky. The free man of color who helped the slave escape was in Ohio. The governor of Kentucky, he got the free man of color got indicted in Kentucky for state violations. The governor of Kentucky asked the governor of Ohio to send him back. The governor of Ohio said, are you friggin' kidding? No way. It went to the courts. The courts ruled that the governor of Ohio had an obligation to send him back, but there was no way for the federal government to enforce it under federalism. So there was an obligation, but no way to enforce it. Years later, Thurgood Marshall said it can be enforced. And so I suspect DeSantis will not turn Donald Trump back. And that will make Donald Trump a prisoner in Mar-a-Lago, a prisoner in Florida. Because if he goes anywhere else, another governor, any Democrat governor, can seize him. So I hope he likes Florida. Let's listen to what he told Lara Trump.
Everyone wants to hear, how are you doing? How has it been down here?
Well, it's been great. It's Florida. It's a beautiful state. It's a well-run state. We had a tremendous election result in Florida, as you know, despite
yes.
millions and millions of dollars being spent against us. And we had a big victory, I guess, unprecedented victory.
So once indicted in New York, and Ron DeSantis refusing to give Donald Trump up or to have him arrested, New York goes to the courts. That will take a while, wending its way through. Meanwhile, Donald Trump will run for president in 2024, but he won't be able to leave Florida. He will have to do all the campaign video, virtually, like Joe Biden, running from Mar-a-Lago, running from Florida, because if he gets to a Democratic state, he will be arrested and sent back to New York. And then if he wins the president, running while under indictment in New York State, sitting in Florida, he would have to get sworn in, not at the Capitol, but in Florida. He would take the oath in Florida, and then once he was sworn in as president, he could travel freely because, as we know, you can't arrest a sitting president. So looking on As I See It Today, Donald Trump runs for president while stuck in Florida, and if he wins, he remains a free man. If not, he'll be the prisoner of Mar-a-Lago. You've been listening to As I See It on News Radio WRVA 1140 AM, 96.1 FM, and on the Odyssey app. We'll see you next week. Have a great week. I'm Howard Gutman.
Thanks for listening to As I See It with Howard Gutman. See you next Saturday morning at 10 for another edition of the show. For more info, log on to WRVA.com. News Radio WRVA.